Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Surviving the Shift, a show where spirituality meets practicality, with your host, Michelle Arbeau.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Surviving the Shift. I'm your host, Michelle Arbeau. And tonight is actually our last episode. It's actually the second from the last. Tonight is the last episode where we're going to have a guest. So next week I'll be having someone interview me, but tonight this is the last episode with a guest, and I'm moving the format over to another show. So I guess tonight we're going to kick off the last and final guest episode with Peter Canova. Peter is an award-winning author who has firsthand experience with the unusual phenomenon portrayed in his books, such as telepathy, remote viewing, intuitive medical readings, and psychic healing. He spent much of his life seeking to understand the forces that link humanity together at an unseen level. In his latest literary work, Pope Annalisa, Peter explores an ancient spiritual tradition which cut across not only Judaism, Christianity, Islam, but also the so-called pagan mystery schools of ancient days. I gotta say, his writing and his personal story are fascinating, to say the least, and what better way to kick off the last show of Surviving the Shift than with Peter. So let's bring Peter on. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Michelle. Nice to be with you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So, Peter, I was really, you know, getting into your book, but I got caught up in the whole switching my show over to another platform, and I've been very busy, so I've had to put it on hold, but I can't wait until I take my plane trip next week so I can read it, because I'll have a lot of time to kill, and it's so fascinating. You know, it is a real page-turner, and you know, I'm hoping you won't ruin too much for me tonight, but I'm fascinated to know more about the backstory of all of this and how you got into this whole, you know, writing about the controversial aspects of spirituality and all that fascinating stuff. So I guess, Peter, welcome to the show, and please start us off by taking us through the beginning. I mean, you came from the business world, you came, you know, completely opposite what you're doing at the moment. So I'd like to know a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, there was really probably nothing in my earlier life that would have indicated where I am now, being an author and writing about this kind of subject matter. But it probably all started off when I was in my 20s. And at that time, I found that I had the ability to do intuitive medical readings. It all started when I attended a course training people to cultivate their other senses, and we on the last day they would pair us up and put us in a corner of a room somewhere, and one person would have an index card with or several index cards with the names, age, addresses of different people, all of whom had either a medical problem or a psychological problem, some sort of issues of that kind, and all they could tell us was the name, age, and address of the person. They were not allowed to give us any more information. And I can remember today the very first case that I did came to me very clearly. It was an elderly gentleman in Miami, and first thing I saw when I closed my eyes was I saw the outline of his body, and I was attracted to the area of the heart, and it looked to me like his heart was tilted at a funny angle, and it indicated that I felt like the aorta somehow being pinched off. And I said, well, I think this gentleman has a blockage in his aorta. And they said, that's correct. What else can you tell us? And I saw something metallic down the bottom quadrant of the heart, and to me that indicated a pacemaker. And I just said, well, I think he's had a pacemaker installed. I see something metallic in there. And they said, and I'm not even sure if pacemakers are metallic, but it seemed that way. These things come to you more in, symbolically sometimes rather than in exact and literal images. But in any case, they said, yes, that's correct. And they asked what year the pacemaker was installed. And I saw the hands of a clock kind of spinning around pretty wildly, but then all of a sudden it stopped at 10, which indicated to me 10 years. And I said, well, I think he had it installed 10 years earlier, which would be 1965. And they said, that's correct. So from that point on, you know, I started becoming, you know, more proficient at doing these readings. And I found it opened up a channel in me. I was starting to, you know, get information and get information that would later bear itself out in my real, you know, real life circumstances. A lot of synchronicities going on. If I would think of somebody that I hadn't seen in 20 years or so, all of a sudden they would appear like sometime within the next week. Just a whole series of things started happening. And I guess what I would liken it to is, you know, I could say that I spent my life up until then sitting by a radio, hearing a lot of static and, you know, kind of tuning the dial, and all of a sudden I hit the right frequency and I found that it was broadcasting 24/7 and it was giving information that was transformative, that would actually help not just myself but other people. And that opened up kind of a whole world that I realized there must be an energy matrix out there that connects us all, because otherwise how would I be able to get such information about other people if we weren't all connected at a deeper level?
Wow, that's quite a story. You know, it's so during the time that you found this out about yourself, that you could do these things and see inside of other people's bodies and know things about people, were you working in the business world at the time? Because I had read through your bio and I thought, wow, this guy came from, you know, a background in business and very, you know, cut and dry and not spiritual at all. So how did that play in to the whole story?
Yeah, I was probably actually just getting out of business school when it happened and just getting into the actual business world itself. It was kind of at a transition point for me, but I spent pretty much the next 30 plus years in the business world. And I for a while in the early days I would do free medical readings for people, and I was kind of living, when I was going to school, I was living in a working class area in Boston. I soon had a line of people outside the door looking for free medical advice, and you know, I would always sort of tell them what I saw, but make sure that they went to their, you know, doctors to talk about what was going on. You know, then later on, I used this during my travels. I traveled around the world, and I went to some dangerous places, and I'm not shy to say that these things saved my life on at least one or two occasions. I started to have people come into my life when I went to Africa and the Far East and everything. I'd be walking down a street and people that I didn't even know would start approaching me. And they were usually, like in Africa, you would call them bush doctors, what we would call shamans or guru. You might want to, if the Far Eastern people I met, you know, had the little turbans, and you might call them gurus. Whatever the names were, they all had one thing in common, which was they were all spiritually oriented people, and they managed to single me out no matter where I was and start talking to me. So this was just another reaffirmation about, you know, the law of attraction, how once your spiritual channels are open, you tend to bring those things into the course of your life.
Yes, yeah, I agree. Yeah, the synchronicities of just certain people showing up and things like that, yes. Okay, so you did a lot of traveling and you did some intuitive work on the side. So was it just the medical intuitive that you were able to do, or was there other stuff that you have stumbled upon that you were able to do?
Oh, there were quite a few things. It was remote viewing and the clairvoyance, clairaudience, psychokinesis, things of that sort, you know, spoon bending and those kind of things. But, you know, to tell you honestly, Michelle, after a while, as I got more mature, I said, you know, these things are great and they're manifestations, but to tell you honestly, what are they, you know, are they really that important? I mean, it's nice, and to be able to do that, it's nice for validation, I think, to give you confidence and a growing sense of, you know, the fact that you were surrounded by these unseen energies. But beyond that, I always look for practical applications of this. And what it really came down to was, later on in my life, I decided that I stopped doing the medical readings and I stopped, you know, doing all these other things. And I said, you know, I've really touched a source of information here. I've had an experience that's led me beyond faith in believing in the spiritual dimension and all these other things to knowledge that it really exists. And there's a huge difference between faith and knowledge. faith is something that you have to take on faith. You have to take a proposition by somebody who is telling you second or third hand, and you know, if it falls into your belief system, well, you believe it, but you haven't experienced it until you've gone through it and it happens to you. And there's a world of difference between the two. And what I wanted to do was to reach people on a much larger scale, on a mass audience, and let them know about the experiences that I had and the things that I've learned that I was hoping to impart to other people. And I decided the best medium to do that was going to be a fictional novel, because there are a lot of people out in the market that write about physical and metaphysical and spiritual matters. And, you know, they all do a good job. You can go into a bookstore and you can pick up books by, you know, Wayne Dyer or Deepak Chopra or, you know, many other authors out there who write about spiritual matters. And I said, so, you know, these people are all out there doing a great job, and I kind of don't want to become, you know, the new person in the woodpile. So I said, you know, I like to hear things in stories. I always find if you can relate to a story and the characters and the plot and the action in a story, that that's the best way to learn, because it involves your heart and your mind and your emotions all at once. And rather than being taught, you absorb. Rather than being lectured to, you kind of live with these characters and these events and things. And so I think people pick up on the subject matter, you know, a lot at a lot deeper level. And some of these things are pretty complex. And if you wrote them down in a book, it would, you know, probably even the best writer would end up being a little academic or dry about it. And I wanted to have the readers have a different type of experience, so I decided to opt for the form of a fictional novel.
Yeah, and you know, Peter, I find that you know, writing fiction around the topic of spirituality is a little bit of a risk, but I think it takes the right author to make it great, because I think you've done that, because, you know, it is a risky thing, because we're so used to having self-help books and you know, spirituality written in that form. You know, we pick up a book and we want to know some facts and we want to know, you know, the background information and things like that. But to write it in a fictional novel is a risk, but I think you've done it so brilliantly.
Well, thank you. I mean, it certainly is a challenge, because these are subjects that otherwise could be really abstruse. They could be, you know, a lot of just dense, and it's kind of hard to talk about profound spiritual issues and yet keep people entertained, not have the book come off like an aborted self-help book. There was something really should have been a self-help book, but somebody tried to put it in a novel, and it didn't really make it. So I found that straddling the line between, you know, revealing some profound spiritual subject matter in the book and making it just a good, thrilling commercial read was the biggest challenge that I had. But by all accounts, I think the book has succeeded, because I find the market that's reading the book is incredibly diverse. Some people just love the story and the plot line and the read and the action and the mystery and, you know, all the other things in the book, and other people totally zero in on the spiritual side of it. So the fact that it can be read by so many different people at so many different levels of understanding is very gratifying, because that's the thing that I probably had to struggle the most with in the writing of the book.
And you're so right, because if you did do this as just your traditional book on spirituality, it would be, your audience would be so narrow, because it's such a controversial, you know, the topics in it, the subject matter that you touch upon, you know, the facts. It's so controversial, yet it does reach a broad audience, because it's done in a way that, you know, it doesn't preach. It just tells a story.
Yeah, and actually, to tell you the truth, even if I'd done it nonfiction, the subject matter, which is, you know, from much of it is from the Gnostic text and talks about the lost Western spiritual tradition of Gnosticism. If you ever read the original Gnostic text, it yeah, how can I describe this to you? Well, fortunately, I speak Greek, so it helps, because the original texts are in Greek, and so I could pick up, even in the translations, I could pick up the meaning of the key Greek words, which are difficult in and of themselves. But the subject matter is so arcane and so coded, and you have to have such a background of, let's say, understanding about what this meant at that time, what this term meant at that time, that I think even the metaphysical group would kind of get lost in it. So what I really had to do was distill. I had to boil it down and boil it down and really distill the meat of what the Gnostics were really saying, cutting away the complex terminology and trying to, you know, sort of decipher for the modern audience what it was saying, and then take that distillation and put it in the form of an interesting book, you know, with it, with all the characters and the action and everything else that goes along with it.
Yeah, I think you've done a brilliant job. From what I've read of it so far, I mean, it's definitely well done. So this is a trilogy, or this is going to be a trilogy, and this is the first of the three books.
It is. It's the trilogy is called the First Souls Trilogy, and it's the saga of the first fall of spirit into material existence. And the books deal with these first souls, these archetypical souls that are really you and me and all of humanity, because their story is our story. And ultimately, the whole series is about the origin, destiny, and purpose of humanity, where we've come from, why are we here, and where are we heading. And it deals with the various incarnations of these characters over different epochs of human history.
Okay, so give us a rundown, just to pique everyone's interest, about the overview of Pope Annalisa. What is it about, and how can you describe it in a nutshell, I guess you could say?
Sure. Well, the book deals with the rise of a miraculous African nun to the papacy against the background of murder, betrayal, and assassination, and it takes place in the near-future world of 2025, which is a rather bleak world, where nations are struggling over dwindling resources and the confrontation between the West and Islam has reached a very dangerous peak. Now, after becoming Pope, and of course I won't tell you how that happens because that would ruin the book for a lot of people, but initially she's under investigation by the Church. The Church Fathers are very suspicious of her because of a series of prophecies that predict the rise of somebody they call the Great Heretic or the Great Deceiver, which is a figure that sounds a lot like Annalisa. And when she finally does become Pope, demonic symbols begin appearing around the Vatican. The Catholic Church breaks apart, and the Western world is divided on the eve of an American nuclear confrontation with Iran, because throughout most of the book, it's not really clear whether this female Pope is going to be the savior of this world or whether she's the destroyer of it, whether she's the one who is really causing the problem. So is she the solution, or is she the problem itself? And it's up to four people in particular to find out the mystery of this female Pope and what exactly she's all about. So it deals with war, religious conflict, and divisive social issues, but it ultimately points to a path for reconciliation by developing, you know, higher awareness of the root problem of the human condition. And some of the themes underlying the book deal with the recovery of a real universal spiritual wisdom tradition that once bound Judeo-Christianity to all major religions, both modern and pagan, in the past. And it's quite a fascinating thing. It gets into the sacred feminine, the early women of Christianity and the Church, and what happened to them. Why did they disappear from history? So it's got a lot of things going on there.
Yeah, it does, definitely. Yeah, and like I say, you've covered so much, and it is a controversial topic, really. I mean, you know, how did humanity come to exist? You know, what is our purpose here? You know, where are we going? You know, all those things are very controversial, but you've done it in a way that appeals to everyone, and it's really great. I mean, how did it come to you? I mean, how did you come upon the topic of, you know, a black woman pope, and how did the story unravel for you?
You know, it was a real process. I was when I started writing, I was hanging around these various writers' conferences, which is the way that a lot of writers get going. It's one of the opportunities that writers, especially new writers, have to kind of sink themselves into, you know, a group atmosphere in what otherwise is a very lonely profession of writing. So I was at one writer's conference in a screenwriting class, and the instructor came in and said, I want you all to bring in a totally novel idea, a high-concept idea that nobody's ever done before. So that's very difficult, because I think almost everything in art has some antecedent to it. It's a little bit of a permutation of something else that came before it. But because I was spiritually oriented, I guess my mind started to vector in a certain way. And I started saying to myself, well, let me see, we haven't really seen a female priest in the Catholic Church anyway before, and certainly not a female pope. And I guess the idea of having it come from Africa certainly had to do with the fact that I lived in Nigeria, which is the initial setting of the book in Annalisa's early days. And I knew that culture very well, and I wanted to portray kind of a juxtaposition between where Annalisa was coming from, which is a culture that had still had religious impulses and spiritual awareness that was still very close to the earth, whereas I perceived that Christianity and the Catholic Church had developed this incredibly elaborate and sophisticated superstructure of theology that in a lot of ways removes the average person from an understanding of spirit. So I think, you know, there were a couple of different reasons why I chose Africa and why I chose a female and a black female. And also I think to, you know, to demonstrate the fact that spirit can come to us in the most unexpected form. Spirit is no respecter of gender, race, creed, or whatever. And the, you know, spiritual truth can come among us in sometimes in the least expected forms.
I agree. And, you know, it's such a perfect symbol to have, you know, a woman who is black, who is a minority, and become Pope. I mean, there's so many unspoken messages in that symbol alone, you know. It's so multi-layered, the whole story and the symbolism, and, yeah, it's just great. I can't wait to read the rest because, you know, I'm trying to not read it, so I have something to read on my trip because the trip is incredibly boring from the east to the west coast, and so this will definitely fill the void, But yeah, I mean, it's. Are you looking to make this into a film later on? Because I think it would make a really great film.
I think there's no question that this book kind of screams out to be a film. It was written very cinematically. It's epic in scope. I think it involves all the kinds of things that Hollywood would like from a commercial level. What I would hope is if it were made into a film, I'd certainly want to make sure that the spiritual content doesn't get overshadowed, you know, in favor of you know, the commercial sensationalism, which because of the book's exciting plot could easily happen. But I think that, you know, when Lord of the Rings was made, when Peter Jackson did Lord of the Rings, I was so happy because I'd read that book when I was a college student, and I thought it was one of the most phenomenal works of imagination in English literature. And I said to myself, you know, the danger is if they ever make this into a movie, because it has these fantastic elements, they'll make it cartoonish and they'll make a joke out of it. And the real drama that's behind this and the symbolism, which tells a lot of very, I think, fundamental truths in that book, you know, would be lost. And he did an unbelievable job in translating the spirit of the book into the film. And if Pope Annalisa is ever made into a film, I hope somebody does as good a job on that book as they did with Lord of the Rings, making it into a movie.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, it's a fine line to make it into this theatrical drama and lose everything. You know, you need to have the right person take this and run with it for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll have to be like the lady who wrote the Twilight series. She had a very big part in the whole process. You'll have to be like that.
Well, I hope I can gain some kind of the leverage, and I hope the book goes as mainstream as the Twilight series did, and then maybe I'll have the leverage to deal with these guys in Hollywood.
There you go. Yeah. Okay, so are you working on the next book already, or are you just kind of taking a break right now from the writing?
If I'm taking a break from the writing, it's only because I have to spend so much time marketing Pope Annalisa. The book has huge potential. To get this book really into the mainstream, it takes a lot of work. Since I do not have a big publishing house behind me, I have to pretty much do it all myself. I have a great publicist out here in Los Angeles, which is Steve Allen Media, and Steve is doing a great job for me, and together we're slowly starting to make inroads, you know, getting the book known through wider circles. And, you know, the hope is that one day we get that break where, you know, oftentimes I'm not really much into the whole cult of celebrity that happens in this country, but, you know, sometimes that's what it takes, that a well-known figure, an Oprah, you know, type of person reads a book and, you know, gets it out there, and, you know, people kind of flock to it. And I'm certainly not shy about having that happen. I would love to be able to, you know, get lucky enough to have a circumstance like that. But I'm really working hard to kind of get the book to go mainstream. Now, the book has won five national book awards in the space of 6 months. So from the critical side, it's doing extremely well from the critical side. I mean, it universally, every professional reviewer, every panel of judges in the book judging contest have given it the highest marks. It's never really failed yet. But, getting awards like that and having the book become a household word is two different sets of circumstances. So the first one, is well on its way. The second circumstance of getting the book to go mainstream to that extent, I'm still working on it. And that does take a huge amount of time. So that is significantly cutting into my writing of the second book. I am making progress on the second book, but it's going to go a lot slower than if I'd already had my marketing goals accomplished for Pope Annalisa.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and besides that, it's all about timing, as we know. So, the second book will come when the timing is right. And, I think you're in the right spot to really promote this now and get it out there and get it more widely known so it can be recognized the way it should be. Because, I was just looking at the bio and the description of the book, and I saw the awards that it's won in just a short amount of time. That's amazing. I mean, that in itself should really propel you to the next level with this. Have you sent the book to Oprah?
Well, it's not that easy to get a book into her, and
yeah.
The answer is we are working on Oprah's group trying to get the book read by people over there. Again, you would think, wow, Black Pope, they'd just snap that up. That doesn't really work that way. It is kind of difficult to get a reading at those levels, but we are working on it, and hopefully it'll click at some point. But the awards have been great, because at least it's been an indication that people really do relate to the subject matter. And what it really shows me is that the potential for this book to be a phenomena is clearly there. A few things have to happen for that to occur, but the content, style, subject matter, and everything in the book is very explosive, and it's something that it's transformative. For those people that have read it, it has touched them in one way or another at a very deep emotional level, and they fall in love with this character and the whole series of events around the book, and that's been universal for everybody that's picked it up and read it. So we just have to get a few more people to get in that space and read it, see if it can take off.
Exactly, yeah, and I think it will. I mean, just, the vibe of the whole story, and I think the world is ready for something like this. And, as a film, I think it would be, people would be buzzing about it for years. I think it would be something, especially because 2012 is coming and the hype building, and, I think that if someone took this and ran with it, of course it probably wouldn't come out until after 2012, but that's the whole point, because after we move towards or past 2012 and this whole hype about, doomsday, then what next? And this is what's next, is, your story and where humanity's going. So this kind of represents the next phase.
Well, I think if the Da Vinci Code was such a phenomenon, this book should be light years beyond the Da Vinci Code in several regards, because the Da Vinci Code kind of deals with the bloodline theory, and the major theme of it was that Mary Magdalene and Jesus had children, and that was kind of the secret at the center of the Da Vinci Code, or at least the purported secret at the center of the Da Vinci Code. Whereas in my book, Mary Magdalene plays a prominent role too, but she is the Holy Grail, just like she was in the Da Vinci Code. But instead of being the Holy Grail as the receptacle of Jesus' children, she's the Holy Grail as the receptacle of the secret knowledge that Jesus was teaching, which is a transformative knowledge. So the Pope Annalisa is actually much more rooted in historical fact and scripture than the Da Vinci Code is. The Da Vinci Code is a great story. Dan obviously, did a masterful job in creating this worldwide phenomena. But I think that Pope Annalisa is equally as exciting, and certainly much more sophisticated and mature in the subject matter and the depth of how it talks about spirituality and the spiritual secrets that it reveals in there, which are by and large mostly rooted in history.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that about, the secret teachings of Jesus. I noticed that on your website, on the Pope Annalisa website, and I was intrigued because I've always had this connection with Jesus. I'm not a religious person. I really, you know, growing up we weren't religious. I didn't really go to church, and you know, there was none of that mainstream traditional religion in my life, but I'd always had this connection to Jesus. So there's, in this book there are is there a reference to those teachings, those secret teachings of Jesus?
Well, there's not only a reference to it, it's the whole underpinning of the book. Book has a lot to do with the teachings of Jesus and the Gnostics. There was, in the ancient world, a whole network of spiritual mystery schools prior to the birth of Jesus, prior to Christianity coming along, and they were teaching a very sophisticated universal wisdom tradition. Now, Orthodox Christianity, as distinct from mystical Christianity, comes along and essentially cuts that chain by giving paganism a bad name and trashing the mystery schools and all the knowledge. It would be akin to burning the Library of Alexandria, where we lost an incredible amount of accumulated human wisdom when Christianity destroyed the mystery schools and the mystical adepts. It was about the same type of thing. We lost a whole spiritual legacy that had very tragic consequences for the world, for the Western world in particular. So these teachings of Jesus, which in my view were actually a continuation of this universal wisdom tradition that had been taught for thousands of years, though Jesus was perhaps the clearest channel and the highest exponent of that teaching, is really the underpinning of the story in the trilogy.
Okay, so tell me a little bit more about these secret teachings, because, you know, is it in reference to... I guess from what we know in the Bible and who Jesus was and what he taught, this takes it further. He's not, you know, I guess a lot of religions twist what's in the Bible to fit their particular religious structure. Could you elaborate a little bit on the secret teachings, I guess you could say?
Yeah, sure. Well, let's talk a little bit about original Christianity, early Christianity. There were two Christianities. Something a lot of people don't know. There was a hidden, mystical inner church, and there was a literal, outer, public church. And what's the evidence for this? Well, the evidence is right in the Bible itself, as well as in the teachings of early, as well as in the letters and documents of early church fathers. In Matthew and Mark and other places in the Bible, it says that Jesus taught parables to the masses, but unto the disciples, you know, he taught the mysteries in private. There's letters by Clement of Alexandria, one of the early well-respected church fathers, the Bishop of Alexandria, who wrote that when St. Peter was executed in Rome, St. Mark came over to Alexandria with Peter's notes and with his own notes, and there comprised a more spiritual gospel for the elect or the spiritually mature, but he did not divulge those publicly, nor did he ever proclaim them by mouth, but he never revealed the secret teachings of the Lord except for those who went through initiations and studies of these scriptures. So it's clear throughout historical Christianity that there were two teachings going on, and that there was a mystical church going on in the background, which was highly sophisticated and spiritual, and then there was the outer church, which eventually the evolution developed along these lines. The proponents of the inner church were the Gnostics. Now, Gnostics were essentially mystics who had been around for over 1,000 years before Christianity. They were part of this ancient universal spiritual tradition in the West. When Jesus came along, they readily embraced Christianity, seeing Jesus to be a continuation of those teachings, and they became the first Christians. They were Gnostic Christians. Later on, in the church, the outer church, or the public church of the parables and the church of structure and hierarchy and priests and bishops and so forth, became the Orthodox Church. And the Orthodox Church did not have any mystical or first-hand understanding of the spiritual mysteries. So they relied on scriptures and other stories and anecdotes and things, and they were big into reciting creeds and having everybody have a common belief. That's what orthodox means. Orthodox means right thinking. Right thinking means there's only one way to think about it. So they developed what eventually became the Catholic Church with its whole structure and hierarchy. Ultimately, they could not put up with the mystical church anymore, because the mystical church said that if you go through these initiations and you learn the mysteries, you will have a direct experience of the divine, which means that your spiritual path or evolution in life should be sought within yourself. You don't need priests, you don't need churches, you don't need any groups as intermediaries between you and God or between you and consciousness, whatever you want to call the supreme being. You don't need an intermediary. So obviously this was a threat. And they ended up literally physically eradicating the mystics, as well as burning and destroying their works. So we lost, and incidentally, today this mysticism actually survives in the other two major Abrahamic religions, because the Jews still have the Kabbalah, and the Islam still have the Sufis and the Ismailis. Those two groups were kindred spirits to the Gnostics. They were their respective mysteries and taught the same things that the Gnostics did within their own respective religions. But Christianity was particularly virulent about the existence of these mystics, and you know, ultimately almost eradicated them from history.
Wow, that's fascinating. You know, I really don't know much about traditional religion. I've kind of steered clear of it and just, I guess, did my own thing and believed what I believed. But, yeah, I always find it so fascinating. I remember picking up a book, and the book was called Jesus. I do believe it was written by, I can't remember who the author was now, but it was called Jesus, and it's a yellow book. And I picked it up at an airport, and I remember reading the whole entire thing during the flight, and I thought, wow, this is amazing. This is really, and it talked about, a little bit about what you just said about these, you know, the other teachings, you know, the things that Jesus really didn't tell mainstream, you know, the community at large, just in private. And so it was interesting to read.
Well, one of the wonderful things about Christianity, at least the original understanding of Christianity, was that it was universal, so that you didn't have to be a Christian in order to understand, in order to relate to the story of Jesus, because the Gnostics would look at the story much more symbolically, you know, than the Orthodox Christians would. Orthodox Christianity is actually a very materialistic religion, because let's just take certain events. Orthodox would look at the birth of Jesus as this big event of a particular person being born, you know, in a manger, whereas the Gnostics viewed the birth of Jesus as symbolic of the advent of a new source of light on the planet to enlighten the planet. It was a new consciousness coming into Earth at that time. So the nativity was much more than just the birth of a physical being. The nativity was actually another dispensation of God, of divine knowledge coming into the Earth. You take a look at the crucifixion. The Gnostics would understand the crucifixion as the death of the ego self that would allow us to grow in spirit, whereas the Orthodox fixated on the crucifixion as a blood sacrifice of a particular human being, a physical blood sacrifice of a particular human being. So because the Gnostics viewed the Christian story symbolically, there was so much more they could take out of it. They could get right back into the archetypical message, the real truth that were behind the Christian story, and not get stuck down at the bottom at this literal level, you know, which is where you can have distortions and everything else occur, because you know if you're just looking at the whole historical story of Christianity, the history of Christianity can always be disputed. You can even dispute whether Jesus was even a real person or not. I mean, many Bible deconstructionists have done that. But if you understand the story symbolically, all of that doesn't really matter. What mattered was that truths were being told that came out of Judea at that time, which are applicable to us even today. So you get a lot more out of Christianity looking at it at a symbolic level rather than at a literal level.
I agree completely, because I, you know, coming from New Brunswick here on the east coast of Canada, it's a very traditionally religious, traditionally Christian communities here in New Brunswick, and that is the biggest turnoff for me in terms of traditional religion throughout my life. It's because they take the Bible so literally, you know, everything is taken, you know, not symbolically and not taken, you know, using the parables and things that are in the Bible, but taking it literally. And I think that was my biggest pet peeve or my biggest qualm with traditional religion.
And there's nothing that says that if you look at the Bible symbolically that that precludes you from a literal understanding also. So, for instance, you know, I personally feel there probably was a person named Jesus of Nazareth, you know, who taught. I don't mean to say that you know, there, that the whole Christian story was a complete fable, but what I am saying is that it adds another dimension. You know, I liken it to this: if our spiritual journey, our particular and personal spiritual journeys, are a process. It's like traveling along a highway. And along that highway, you'll see way stations, or bus stops, let's call them, or way stations. And you stop into each one as you go along the way, and you take what you can from there to complete the next leg of your journey. Now, traditional religion or Orthodox religion would want you to stay in any of those particular way stations and punch your ticket, because they'll tell you, well, we have the whole, all the answers here. We have the be-all and the end-all here. But as a spiritual seeker, you're much wiser just to, you know, to take what they have to offer and then go on to the, you know, the next stage, because spirituality is not a stagnant thing where you're going to find all your answers at one time. The truth doesn't come to us like that. The truth is vast, and it comes to us in stages, and we have to mature into it, and we have to travel and seek, and we have to be spiritual adventurers. And if you cut yourself off by staying in just one spot, then you really kind of put yourself in a box. So I would say that, you know, these spiritual teachings and even the book Pope Annalisa is nothing more than a signpost. It's an indication and a way towards spirit, but we caution, never mistake the signpost for the destination.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I'm going through personally myself something similar, and I really resonated with you in the beginning when you were talking about doing medical intuitive readings and then finally realizing that, you know, this is great that you can do this and, you know, you get to help people, but, you know, there was more to it than just doing that. And I'm coming to that point as well. It's kind of like an onion and you're peeling back the layers. You know, you kind of, like you say, you have to take, you know, learn something and then move on and keep going and not just stay stagnant. So for me, you know, doing readings and things like that, I think I've come to a place now where, yeah, it's great to do that and to help people and, but I'd like to broaden my horizons and, you know, take the labels off and just say, okay, you know, I do intuitive numerology work and I do that, but do I really have to stick in that label and still, you know, stay within those boundaries? So I'm kind of going through an image crisis right now. So I'm really, you know, opening the doors up and just kind of making it broader, you know, so I can keep going.
Well, you know, I did the same thing, and I think it's important, not just for your personal growth, but I think it's important for what you can contribute to other people, because what you're really saying is that you're maturing and your horizons are broadening, and as, you know, your horizons broaden, that what you have to offer to humanity also should be able to broaden also. And I just felt that I could reach more people at different levels by my writing and what I'm doing now than I could sort of sitting in a room with individual people, giving them medical readings. You know, again, That's helpful and that's good, and there's people out there doing that, and that's important work. But, you know, I think some people get to a point, like you say, where you kind of get the itch and you say, you know, I think I could be doing this in a different way. I think I could be reaching more people.
Exactly. And, you know, I've come to that place too. You know, I feel like the writing, I'm doing my first book as well, and doing radio, of course, and also branching out into online TV. So I think, you know, that's where I'm at today. Maybe I won't be there in a year from now, but I'm just leaving the door open. So, yeah, I think I've come to that place where, I guess, taking the labels off, and that's what traditional religion does as well. I mean, they label, right? And so, yeah, anyway, that's I'm relating my own story to that in some strange way, but yes.
Yeah, well, I think it sounds to me like you're probably on the right track. It sounds like you're doing, you know, in your version of what, you know, what I did. But I think at the heart of it, the impulse is not just to grow yourself, but I think in your case, as in mine, you seem to have a desire to help people, and what you learn, you're hoping to impart to other people, not so they can trace your footsteps, because no one can trace our footsteps exactly, but they can trace your direction, and it gets them to think about their own way of traveling that path.
Exactly. You said it perfectly. Well, you know what, Peter, we have a lot of people in the chat room, but I put it out there, and I said, does anyone have a question for Peter? And no one has responded, which is interesting. So I don't know if they're overwhelmed by your knowledge and expertise, which I certainly am. I mean, you definitely know your stuff. But I'd like to put it there as well. If anyone would like to call in, if they have a question or comment for Peter,
okay,
we
come
have
on,
a toll free.
Folks, ask some questions, call in. I love to talk to people. I actually like talking to people, answering questions more than I like lecturing, so please ask some questions.
Okay, so the call in number, it's toll free. It's 1-877-296-0345. So definitely call in. Peter's waiting. He'd like to chat with you if you have a question or comment. Or also, everyone who's in the chat room, if you do have a question for Peter, you can type away and I'll ask him. So Peter, I guess we'll just keep chatting and hopefully someone will either come on the line or to give us a question through chat.
Great.
So I guess I've gone through most of the questions that I had for you. The only other question I had for you, Peter, was that I wanted to know how your family felt about the work that you've done in the past, like the medical intuitive readings and also your controversial spirituality writing and things like that. How do they feel about that?
Well, they didn't have any adverse reaction to all these things. I think they were more like, huh, what's this about? I think they were kind of puzzled. I think they were probably a little skeptical about it. I know when I wrote the book, my mother said, why are you going to write a book about religion? No one's going to want to read that. So, you know, I don't think they quite understood. Now, I did do some medical readings for instance, for my mother-in-law, my brother's mother-in-law. So my brother started to become a little bit more of a believer in these things. And I think over a period of time by osmosis, my family did, you know, get affected by it. I know my brother recently went through an experience, a health crisis, and I think that perhaps the conversations that we had or what he saw me do over the course of the years kind of set the context for him to believe some different things that that helped him in his healing process, even though he went by, you know, conventional medical route and everything else. He also had some spiritual... I actually had a pretty intensive degree of spiritual healing that went on with a gentleman that he worked with, and I think that his mind was kept open to the possibility of that happening by the association he had with some of the ideas and things that I was talking about. So ultimately, over a period of time and by osmosis, I think my family, you know, decided to gradually, absorb and, accept this, even though they probably had some questions or skepticism about it. And now my mother's just, you know, thrilled at the book's success and all the awards and everything, you know, coming in. And it took a little time, though. It didn't happen overnight.
Yeah, and I do find that. I find that those who are involved in, you know, I guess, metaphysical type spirituality or a broader sense of spirituality, not just traditional religion, and who go on to affect the masses, they usually have families that are less than supportive or that don't really get it or, you know, something along those lines. I usually find that it
Wasn't that the story of Jesus? A prophet is never respected in his own land. It's right out of the Bible. His own family didn't believe in him and questioned him. And I'm not trying to compare myself to Jesus or a prophet, but I think when you reach out of the ordinary and you have an experience like that, it is kind of a lonely experience. Unless somebody else has had that experience, it's just so alien to or counterintuitive to what we experience in everyday life. I mean, physical reality is a product of but another dimension of spiritual existence, and that spiritual dimension is so different that when you tap into that, it's sort of like, you know, if you've been to another country and you've witnessed some exotic rituals, you might go back and tell your family about it, but it's so alien to them, they can't really believe it, and they're not sure if you're exaggerating or what you're saying is true. Well, maybe it's kind of true, but they must be exaggerating. It's the same way. You've been to you've had an adventure in a foreign land, and when you try and bring those tales back and tell people, and especially, you know, tell them how you've been affected by it, it's very hard for them to understand.
Yes, I agree. And, you know, I have a unique perspective on that. I actually died when I was 4, and I remember leaving my body, and everything looked like a distorted bubble. And the other side really is a lot different. You know, it's I was only 4 at the time, but I do remember it like it was yesterday because it was such a profound experience that it keeps me centered in my purpose and what I'm here to do. You know, just remembering that memory. So, yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell other people what it's like and actually make them understand or show them exactly what we're trying to say.
Yeah, and, you know, ultimately, the best you can do is that people have an acceptance on an intellectual level. And that is a beginning. We have to use our heart and our mind together to reach enlightenment. And we can start it off with an intellectual proposition. You can read books by spiritual masters. And you can get a context of understanding and start to build up a desire to have that experience. But then you have to bring that intuitive side in. You have to start to cultivate your intuitive side and bring the desire factors in. So you're using both the right and left brain. You're using the male and the female qualities within you, logic and intellect, and verbalization on one side, conceptualization on one side, which is the male side, and then feeling, intuition, creativity, which is the female side. Those attributes have to come together within your being in order to reach into these other dimensions and have that kind of an experience, which is why in the Gnostic Gospels, Jesus was always quoted as saying the two must become one, which means that we have to bring these polar aspects of our personalities into balance in order to become actualized human beings and have these kinds of experiences.
Yeah, it's all fascinating to me. You know, I have to clarify, I guess, for people listening, when I had mentioned that I died, I don't want people to think I'm crazy. You know, it was a brief near-death experience is what I guess I should have said. So, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I totally agree that, I guess we all have our own sense of reality or sense of spirituality, so your experience and my experience are totally different, yet still valid and still real, you know? And there's not one right way or wrong way. There's infinite ways. I guess that's how I see it.
Well, there is, and, you know, you can reach the same place by multiple doors, and most people do. Nobody's path is exactly the same as somebody else's, but that doesn't mean that it's all relative. There is an absolute truth out there. Now, we don't experience it in this dimension. This dimension is all about relative truth. There is no absolute truth in the dimension we live in. We have to go through a series of relative truths to propel us along the path to perhaps touching an absolute truth, which resides, and it doesn't reside, when I say another dimension, it does not reside outside of ourselves. These things are never outside of ourselves because all energy is one. We are one with God. We are of God's essence projected into material experience. What we're really doing is we're tracing back the source of our own consciousness up a chain of being, up a chain of consciousness through different levels. So when we go or we have a near-death experience, or we do the type of meditations that I did where we touch upon this information, what we're doing is we're working our way back up the ladder, and we're touching different levels of this consciousness of which we're, you know, sort of, let's say, the end product down here at the most dense end of the chain, the material end.
I like that. I like that analogy that we're climbing the chain of consciousness. I like that. So, Peter, do you believe in God as being a being, or is this, you know, you do believe that it's just energy, right? I mean, it's consciousness or just energy.
Well, I do believe that it's consciousness. I mean, I don't know that, can't really say that God has a body like we do, but I think there's certainly a conception of a human archetype within the mind of God, because as it is above, so it is below, and I think that's probably one of the greatest truisms in the world. So when it says that we are in the image of God, I believe that there is some truth to that. There's certainly an archetypical thought that the supreme consciousness must have had that formed the template for a human being, which is a fusion of spirit in a material body. So at some level, I believe in that archetype. I believe that archetype is out there. But I believe that everything stems from consciousness. It's consciousness is the ground of all being, which is where quantum physics is starting to head now in the direction of what the ancient spiritual masters have been saying for 2,000 years, the parallels between the findings in quantum physics and ancient mysticism are phenomenal. I mean, the Big Bang is what the Gnostics were saying 2,000 years ago about creation, the parallel universe theory, the holographic universe theory, information theory, chaos theory, all these things that are coming out of quantum physics have direct analogs in the Gnostic writings if you strip away the fact that in ancient times they didn't have particle colliders and scientific or technological terms. So they expressed what they saw at these subjective and intuitive levels in the language of their time and the medium that they used in order to reach people to bring back this complex information in a way that the uneducated masses of that time could begin to comprehend it was by the use of myth. And myths aren't fantasies. Myths are actually symbolic allegories of very deep archetypical truths if you cut to the heart of most of the myths. And you can see the commonality between the Norse and the Greek myths and the Hindu myths and so forth. You can, if you've studied and you know how to do it, you can see they're pretty much saying the same thing, which is bringing back some stories of archetypical truths that these people intuited at the higher dimension. And fascinatingly, quantum physics is heading in exactly the same direction with all their theories about reality and the origin of life.
Wow, you know, this is also fascinating. You know, I've never really delved deeply into, you know, all of this. And it's so factual. You know, the way that you present it and the way that you're talking about it to me, and I really like that because I'm very practical and I like to have a lot of fact with my faith. So it just is also fascinating to me. It really is. So, Peter, we have a few minutes left. So I guess you do have a website, do you, that people can go on the website to look at more information about you and also about purchasing your book?
Yeah, I do. It's popeanalisa.com. That's popeanalisa.com. And the website has videos. It's got a bunch of articles about the things that we've talked about and some other things we haven't talked about, Mary Magdalene, the Gnostics. It goes into a whole segment about quantum physics and ancient mysticism. There's a lot on that website that's some fascinating information. And for anybody that wants to read the book, if you can't get it through your local bookstore, almost every bookstore has the ability to order it. It's on everybody's databases. Or you can go to Amazon.com where they have some great reviews that you can read before you buy the book. Or even Barnes & Noble, I think, and Borders.com, if you have that up in Canada, those websites there, you can purchase the book off of those websites. And I have, I also have a lot of radio interviews, archived radio interviews that I've done in the past on different topics and things like that. So there's some sources of information out there about the book and about the themes behind the book.
Great. You know, when I finish the book, Peter, I'm going to send you my official review of it because I know it's going to be fabulous, and I'll have to send you something definitely because I know I won't be able to keep quiet.
Well, I appreciate that, especially if they go on Amazon.com, because the thing I like about the Amazon or, you know, any of the reviews on the book sites like BarnesandNoble.com or Amazon.com, they're very helpful because when other readers go there, they can, you know, go through the reviews and see what other people have said about it before they, you know, decide to plunk the money down. So I always love to get those reviews. They're very helpful.
Yes, I will do that, definitely, most certainly. So thank you so much, Peter. It was a pleasure, and, you know, you've really piqued my interest on a lot of topics, and I think I'm going to not only read your book, but also do a bit of research on my own. So thank
you
for
that. Well, thanks for having me today, and I hope you get a chance to finish Pope Annalisa on your cross-country flight, which is probably going to be about 6 hours. Yeah.
Yes, actually 8, but yes.
Okay, so you have
all
even
right,
more
thank
time.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you again.
Great, thank you. Bye-bye. All right, guys. This is the last show, a guest show. But next week, the tables are going to turn, and I'm going to be interviewed by my business partner and editor, Marlene Olton. So she's going to be interviewing me about switching the show over to Authentic You Radio, and so we're going to be just chit-chatting about things and about my future plans for Authentic You Media, which includes not only radio but also TV. So tune in next week for the final episode. Thanks, guys. Have a great night.